ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधिताम् भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथिताम् पुराणम् विना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीम् भगवतीम् अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी.
निराश्यतचित्तात्मा
चित्तसर्वपरिग्रहः शारीरं केवलं कर्म कुर्वन्नाप्नोति किल्बिषम्. निराशीः यत चित्त आत्मा त्यक्त सर्व परिग्रहः शारीरं केवलं कर्म कुर्वन् न आप्नोति किल्बिषम्. In these few verses, beginning with the last verse actually, Krishna is talking about different types of jnanis, different types of lifestyles of jivamuktas, of sannyasis, and of people who have knowledge. So remember in the first verse 20, he said the person who, having given up that asanga, that very strong attachment to karmapala, tyaktva karmapala asangam, nityatriptaha nirashriyaha, they are always satisfied. Because of the nature, like the meditation, because of the nature of my own swarupa, my own being, the mind stays there. They're not going after karmapala. Karmapala means the results of actions, the results of my actions, so that I can become happy. So the karmapala, that I have an asanga, that attachment, strong attachment to the fruits of my actions, so that I can be happy. That's what we mean by the asanga. It's not that you don't have, you always do a karma for a particular action. It's just not that you don't know that. But that asanga, that I have to have that result for my own well-being, that's what's not there. I can go for a karmapala, but I can accept the results as really, with the karma yoga buddhi, as prasad from the Lord. I don't take it that my ananda, my wholeness, my well-being is at stake by whether I accomplish this particular karmapala. So that allows for my mind to be at rest. That's the nitya tripti, because the nature of your swarupa is whole. It is that satisfaction is natural to who you are. That's why, like when this time and last time I focused on that in the meditation, if you let yourself give up, just let go of all of your pursuits. I need this and I need that and I have to do this and I have to do that. Chasing after all of these things. You just let it go for the moment and see who is the person. Who are you? Who is the conscious being that you are that is abiding there, you know, as the witness, as present to all of this? What is the nature of that one, of that conscious being? That one conscious being, the nature, if we were to give an affect to it, it's a nitya tripti, right? That satisfaction, it's a constant state of well-being. Not a conscious, constant state, as though there could be another state. Its very swarupa is that wholeness. So that tripti or tripta, that state of always being satisfied, if you look at those words as pointing to your very nature, rather than pointing to a condition that you might sometimes be enjoying, but have it point to the very nature of the self, of the person who is there abiding in all of these different states of experience that you're having, all the varied states of experience, varied emotions, varied moods. There's always somebody there present. You're present to all of them. What is the swarupa? What is the nature of that one? That is nityatripti. It's constant, changeless wholeness. It's nirashriya. Nirashriya means that one is not dependent on anything. Jnani is not dependent on anything for that wholeness because it's your nature. Not dependent on anything in the world for that well-being because it's your changeless swarupa. It's the nature of the Atma. And so the Jnani who has given up all of this attachment to these karma polas, let me have this so I can be happy, let me have this so that I can be happy, the mind is kind of abiding like a calm ocean, right? And not creating a lot of ripples that are competing or adding their 2 cents to your well-being. They're adding their 2 cents to your well-being means all of the different emotions and feelings and things that are going on in the mind are at rest. And so the mind is enjoying just a natural state of satisfaction. Or the mind which is rippling around is, for Jnani, rippling around enjoying the presence of myself that is still and calm and whole. So they're talking here about actually a Jnani, in this one, who's simply engaged in action, living in the world. Because in the next one it says, next line it says, even though completely engaged, karmani abhipravrittopi, even though completely engaged in the world, like Janaka, like Swamiji, totally engaged, you know, in the world, still, it says, naiva kinchit karoti saha, that person doesn't do anything. They see themselves as doing anything because the Atma doesn't do anything. And so yourself is abiding there. All of this activity is going on, but it's not, I am not doing anything, nor am I being affected in any way. And so they're just describing now Jivan Mukta, a Jnani, a person who is liberated, who is active and living in the world. In this next verse, they're talking about a sannyasi, the lifestyle of a sannyasi. Nirashihi means one who is free from ashihi, means hopes and expectations. Well, they don't have these hopes and expectations where, you know, now if I could just do this, then maybe that would happen. Trying to, you know, the imaginative mind, trying to create a nice future for myself. That nirashihi, that is not there. Because myself is changeless. There is no past or future for myself. I am the self of the past, present, and future. Right? Your being is changeless. It's not going to become. You're not going to lose yourself, and you're also, you know, not going to become. And so the self that you are now is timeless. Right? And so there's nothing to be gained. There's something to be. Now the question is, you can say, oh, how boring. You mean this is it? Well, this is the question. That's why I asked you to sit with yourself. Is the self boring? Is the swarupa, the very nature of your being, the me, boring? You know? Is it just so that you can do things that you want to live one more day? Or do you want to live one more day? See, it's a big difference. I want to live one more day so I can do this, this, and this. You can say that, but when you analyze it, then I could ask you, well, what if you can't do this and this? Do you still want to live one more day? Yeah. Why? Why? Aren't you getting bored with yourself? You know? We can say another way. Love is not boring. You know, wholeness, well-being is not boring. And so what is the nature of your very being? I don't think that you would say that consciousness or being or the me is boring. Right? If it's not boring, right? If it's not boring, then the timelessness of myself is not a question. If it's not boring, I don't get tired of myself. Right? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
If you're not boring, you can't get tired of yourself. If the nature of the very swarupa of your nature is wholeness or completeness, it's not a matter of getting tired of yourself. Right? And so for a jnani, in fact, another way of saying this, everything I do, there's some beautiful verses on this, but everything that I do in life, just as a samsari, who am I doing it for? It's another interesting thing. Who am I really doing it for? You say I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing it for love. You can say like that. I'm doing it for love. I'm doing it for well-being. I'm doing it for wholeness. I'm doing it for happiness. I'm doing it for completeness. Whose completeness? You could say, well, my family's completeness. Why do you want your family to be complete and whole? Because I would be miserable if they weren't complete and whole. It always gets back to my own wholeness. You know, and somebody said to Swamiji, how selfish. Are human beings selfish like that? They're just doing everything for their own happiness, for their own wholeness. Isn't that really egotistical and self-centered? And then you have to say, well, what would they, say if a person is doing things for their own happiness. If you say that that is egotistical, then would it make sense then that they're doing things for their own unhappiness? See what I mean? Would somebody be doing something for their own unhappiness? Now, you wouldn't say that would be normal. You would say, no, that would be abnormal. That would be sick. But if you say they're doing something for their own happiness, you know, that it actually is normal. That everything that I do is for my own happiness in the end. Even taking care of my family, taking care of my children, all of the charity that I do, all of the dharma that I do. If I did dharma and I found out that dharma made me unhappy, by doing dharma, it would be like sticking my hand in fire. I would learn not to do it. Now, in the end, in fact, as a person matures, what they learn is that they would rather do dharma over any type of pleasure seeking. Why? Because it gives me more happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that I would rather give than take, because giving gives me more happiness. Taking starts to make me feel small, right? And so, what does it mean? Even dharma, even giving love, even caretaking, every one of these things is done because it makes me feel whole and complete. Now, the thing is, what's really going on there is that I already am whole and complete. The conscious being that I am, the awareness itself, already is completely whole and complete and constant. My mind, because of self-ignorance, can get itself into conditions where it is having an opposite experience, right? Of isolation, like any type of adharma, for instance, is giving me an opposite experience. Any type of, you know, hatred or anger or violence or any of these type of things, they give a sense of isolation and incompleteness. And so what I keep learning, what the universe continues to teach us on a relative level, is the more dharmic you are, the more loving you are, the more giving you are, you know, the more happiness you have, because your mind is at rest, right? So that's why all of this karma yoga, all of these values are so important, because on a relative level, it gives the mind a state of rest, a state of calm, which then in no way competes with my own well-being. A quiet mind is not not competing with me. If the mind is quiet, then I, who am the very conscious being of the mind, right, am really come to the foreground of the mind. You know, rather than the mind being a rippling ocean, I'm there as the fore. I'm the very self of the mind. But when the mind is relaxed, then my being is what is predominant. My own presence is what is predominant in that mind, right? Because the mind isn't agitated. How do I feel when my mind, when I am the predominant one, you know, in the mind? I feel whole and complete, and all is well with me, and I'm happy. You know? So what about the jnani who recognizes, right, that all of the mind really needs is to be quiet? That's it. It just needs to be quiet. It needs to be relaxed. Quiet means relaxed. It doesn't have to stop thinking. It just simply needs to be relaxed. Because if it is relaxed, it's not getting itself into a condition that's causing pain. Because pain is not your swarupa. Pain isn't your nature. But the mind can get into terrible pain. You know, because we want things to be this way or that way. It's the whole samsara. It gets into terrible pain. But how do we get out of it? Relax. That's all. Relax means what, though? You know, relaxing means that you have to accept the way things are. And accepting this is the whole karma yoga. Accepting Ishwara, accepting the way things are, then I can act to change it. If I don't accept the way things are and act to change it, then I have a lot of suffering. If I accept the way things are and then act to change it, I don't have suffering. And then I accept the results of my actions as prasad from the Lord. But only a jnani can really do it, you know. Only a jnani can really accept the way things are, because only a jnani means one with self-knowledge. Their being isn't at stake. Their wholeness isn't at stake. The ananda that an ajnani seeks in the world, right? The wholeness that an ajnani seeks in the world, ajnani isn't seeking in the world. It's a huge difference. I seek ananda, I seek the world to be in a particular way so that I can be whole. Whereas the jnani doesn't seek the world to be in a particular way so that I can be whole. Because the jnani is the one who has recognized that the wholeness that I'm seeking doesn't belong to the world, it is the very swarupa, the very nature of the self. And so it stops, as the mind matures, the seeking stops. The seeking, trying to get my wholeness out of the world, stops. And then when it stops, what does that mean? Is that I now am in, I am in this world as it is, not requesting it to be different for my happiness. And so that allows me to engage in the world as it is and act and try to be a helpful, useful person. You know, and when you see somebody who's really mature, very mature in their knowledge, this is what stands out about them. Is that, at least, I always think Swamiji is my role model, of course, so, you know, and he's a wonderful role model for this type of thing. Mm. But it's that seeing a person, when you're with a person, who totally accepts the situation as it is, totally, and then sees what needs to be done here to make it better. If there's a problem, how can I be helpful? This is a situation, you know, how can I be helpful? Because if your ananda isn't at stake, then you can have that attitude. How can I be helpful? How can I help in this situation? Or what can I do here? Because here you are in the situation. And there's never a time in your life when you can't say, here I am. Always, it's here I am in this situation. And so how can I be helpful in this situation? That the ease of that thought comes when you're not asking the situation to be in a particular way that will allow you to be happy. And so that's why in this whole chapter 4, in fact, so many of these verses, Krishna is going through verse by verse, kind of trying to give you the, talking about a jnani, but trying to kind of give you the vision of it. So here, when he says, nirashihi, the one who doesn't have these hopes and expectations means needs. I don't need you to be in a particular way. So there's that. Then the next thing, this is for all for a sannyasi now. Yeta chitta, that applies to us also. Yeta chittatma, the one whose body, mind, and senses. Chitta is the mind, the atma here is the body and sense organs. Yeta chittatma, they're using atma here, so this is the body. The one whose body, mind, sense organs are yet, that means under their control. Instead of the body and the mind taking you, right, it's something that you use as an instrument. This physical body actually is your instrument. Your mind is an instrument. Your sense organs are an instrument for you to use, to make use of. But they can also, because of desire, because of ajnana, make use of you. So if you have this body, mind is an instrument that you can use. That's yata chittatma. Then he says, syakta sarva parigraha. Parigraha just means here, possessions. The one who has given up all possessions. In fact, a sannyasi, for the most part, has no possessions. They've given all of those up. And even if they have a few things here and there, it's just for the support of the body. So they're talking here actually about a sannyasi. But a sannyasi, one who wears the orange. Right? Because they're talking, you know, the one who has actually physically given up, walked away from all possessions. But you can have that by guna also, by quality also, which means whatever possessions you have, you don't have that mamatvam. This is mine, this is mine. Which means like, just like a balloon, what do you call these hydrogen balloons?
Right? Helium.
Helium balloons. The helium balloon goes up, you can enjoy its flight. So here, all of these things that are your possessions, you can look at them as, these things are here as long as they're here, and if they go, that's fine also. So that's by guna. You enjoy that by guna. But a sannyasi does give up everything. In fact, when they take the sannyasa, the guru, teacher, takes the brahmachari down to the Ganga. They shed all of their clothes, everything. And they've all taken off all of their hair. They shed all of their clothes. And the brahmachari is given the cloth, and then he turns his back and walks away from the teacher. They both stay separate. He comes back, but it's a ritual, you know, where they've given up absolutely everything, you know, and then they come back. But now, no ownership. And in India, there's some of Swamiji's sadhus are very much living this way. No ownership. In fact, I know one of the swamis, he's given up absolutely everything. He gave all of his books. He gave everything. He just has one or two books that he keeps for his study. Everything else. He has a few dhotis, you know, the orange. That's all. Nothing else.
Who's that?
I'm not saying.
Oh.
There's a lot of them like that. Because he wouldn't like me talking about it.
Yeah.
You know? I'm just saying, but this is the taking that sannyasa, you can see how, what type of a lifestyle that is. But it's a lifestyle that is a symbolic statement of the truth. The truth being that yourself is absolutely whole and complete, and you don't need anything. And so sannyasa, in a sense, symbolizes all of that. You can have that exact same buddhi, that exact same knowledge, in the midst of all kinds of possessions. But your lifestyle isn't symbolic, you know, of that fact. The sannyasi's lifestyle, with their orange, you know, orange even stands for the fire of knowledge that has burned away all of the ignorance. And all of their vows and whatnot, you know, are just a symbol. Their whole life is a symbolic expression of the knowledge. And so then they say again, shariram kevalam karma kurvan. Kurvan, present participle, doing. Doing karma only the kevala karma, only karmas which are sharira, for the sake of the body. Right? In other words, they have to take care of the, what do you have to, you have this body, you have to take care of it. You have to feed it, you have to wash it, you have to clothe it, you have to give it shelter. So there's basic needs that the physical body has. So those physical needs they take care of. Right? And that's what their job is. The rest of the time is just spent, you know, studying and with the Shastra and whatnot. So their only thing that they have to do, you know, is take care of the needs of the physical body. So living that way, and it says, na'apnoti kilbishan, they don't attain, they don't gain any type of impurities. Kilbishan is impurity or sin, you know, papa. So they just live very, very simple life, not asking anything, not wanting anything. But you have to see also, they have the discipline. They don't have any ownership of anything, and they're not looking for anything. But this is kind of the natural state of mind of a jnani. It was. It's not there. The Krishna isn't saying you take sannyasa because this is Arjuna's problem. This because Arjuna thinks, you know, I've seen these kind of people. I should go and do this. Right? That's his problem with Krishna. Shouldn't I go to the forest and take sannyasa and give up everything and you know be a jnani like that? And Krishna says, that is not the way to become a jnani. To become a jnani, you need to gain knowledge. And to gain knowledge, you have to have, to gain that sarvakarma sannyasa, that complete renunciation, to gain that knowledge, you need to have an antakarana, a mind. That is, has a raga dvesha, likes and dislikes neutralized, to some extent, so that your mind is really capable of realizing your own svarupa. To do that, the best way to do that is to stay in the world and do karma yoga. Because if you stay in the world and do the karma yoga, then all of the things that cause you problems will still be here to torment you. They'll still be here. They'll still be here to challenge you, right? You think you can run away from them, you can't. If you try to run away from your problems here and go sit in the forest, you'll take all of those problems with you internally, right? And they'll find ways of sprouting out, but sprouting out in your more limited situation. Whereas if you stay here, all of the things that can possibly bother your psyche are here, waiting for you. So the world is a perfect sadhana. It's your what do you call it? Personalized. The world, your world is your personalized sadhana. Right? And it is. We all know it for ourselves. You know, and the challenges don't stop coming. Same challenges. You know, like that Groundhog Day or whatever. The same challenges will not stop hitting you until they aren't challenges for you anymore. Mm-hmm. And what the uncanny thing about that is that you think that, oh, that doesn't bother me. I don't even notice that anymore. Right? All those things are still happening. Same things. Same horrible things. But they just don't bother you. So you don't notice them. It's not that they've gone away. We think they stop. They don't stop. It's just they don't bother you. You've outgrown that particular thing. You know? That's it. So it's really an amazing thing. It's so completely true. It's on a mundane or different kind of level. It's like this. If you decide you need a new car, you've decided you're going to buy a Volvo. I was going to buy a Volvo at one time. Then when you're driving around, you see all the Volvos, right? Because your psyche is set for that. It's the same with complexes. If you have a complex, your psyche is waiting for it. It'll see it wherever it comes. Somebody lifts their eyebrow in a particular way. There it is. Right? So until you've outgrown that particular complex, it will be hitting you from all angles. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as we mature and grow, then those certain things, no longer we don't notice them. They're there. The whole world is here at us all of the time. But what is the stimuli we're responding to? Right? We're responding to the things that trigger us in one way or another. We're responding to our own samskaras. You know what I mean? We have these samskaras. And then the world is fitting into that, to those samskaras in one way or another, positively and negatively. Positively is not a problem, unless I cling to the positive. And that's a huge problem, because nothing stays. The negative is an obvious problem, because we're hurt by it. So that's where the real work is, you know? And until we do it, we're tortured by it. And that's how the universe is, you know, people say that the universe is the great, great teacher. It is a great teacher, but if you think about what makes it a great teacher, you know, is our own, our ignorance, and then, you know, beginningless lifetimes accumulated some scars and tendencies, you know, and then continuing to relate to the world in a way that it isn't, in a way that isn't true to the world. And so we say the world is a great teacher. Why? Because it's not teaching, it's not doing anything. It's being what it is. But we're being toward it. We're being toward the world, toward Ishvara, in a way that the world is not. And so then it's not cooperating. And we say, well, it keeps teaching us. Well, it does keep teaching us. It's teaching us what it isn't, continually.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And eventually, as you become, you know, your hair gets on fire, which is how they talk about a mumukshu. It's like, my God, there's no way out of this. There is no way to win this game. There is no way to make the world into something, you know, or make my situation into something that will make me happy. You know, I have to rather find a way to be happy in my situation. Not to try to make my situation something that will make me happy. I have to be happy in my situation. That's the change that has to take place. But to say that, how can I be happy in my situation if I'm not happy? Right? It's ridiculous. I can't be happy in my situation if I'm not happy.
Mm.
But that's why a person needs knowledge. Because you have to realize that you are happy. That your self is the very source of ananda. And that's what is making you appear to be unhappy is maya. That's not true. It's not true. The mind is making you appear to be unhappy. The world is making, your relationship with the world is making you appear to be unhappy. But what is illumining that appearance of unhappiness is the ananda of your own being. And so all of this confusion has to be sorted out so that the mind can sit back and relax, right? Because you are fine. In fact, the very ananda that you seek is your own nature. But it requires allowing the universe to be what it is. And that requires a tremendous amount of knowledge on my part that doesn't take place overnight. Right? Because the person who comes to the knowledge is the person who says, every person, not just one person, I am this individual living in this, I am this pocket of consciousness living in this world, and I need to become happy. Right? So I'm totally extrovert, really. How to become happy? How to make myself happy? How to fulfill my needs? How to make things work out in such a way that I'll be a happy person? And the subtlety of this quest is astounding. It's not just a gross thing, well, if I could have a new house, or if I could get, you know, a new car, or maybe if I could make more money, or maybe I should have more parties and, you know, have more people over, or, you know, maybe I should change my diet. That's all on a gross level. But it even gets, you know, subtle, how I should feel, how I should be thinking, how I should be doing this and that. Yeah, but it's all, we're all seeking. And because we have lifetimes of that. That's the samskara that we have. And the knowledge tells me something totally different, right? The knowledge tells me I am what I seek. Period. I am what I seek. And the self that I am is the self of the whole. And so the mind has to get used to that. Because the mind is used to having an externalized experience of me instead of just relaxing and enjoying me. For the jnani, the clinging is of the mind's clinging is of the self. We don't call it clinging. We say the mind is revels in the self. The mind reveling in the self enjoys the world. Right? The mind reveling in the self experiences the world. The reveling in the self engages in the world. But it's that reveling in the self that allows me to engage in the world and accept the world as it is. Because if I'm already happy, I don't have to have the world make me happy. But there's this period of adjustment that takes place over time, where even though I know that, not just intellectually, even though I know that, my mind has lifetimes of knowing something else. Right? And we have to be sympathetic to that situation, because it's true. My mind has a lifetime of behaving in a way that the thinking that somehow the world and others have to behave and do this and that in such ways to make me happy, or I have to get this or that. It's very complicated, all the things that I require. And it's slowly over time that all unwinds in the light of my knowledge. Not overnight. Over time it unwinds. And it's something that I enjoy, experiencing that unwinding. Like Swamiji says, you know, like a like watching a rosebud, you know, so beautifully unfold over time into a beautiful flower. It has its own organic, natural process of unfoldment. And the psyche has its own very natural, organic process of unfoldment in the light of this knowledge. And so part of what we can do is enjoy and be helpful, have a proper attitude and enjoy and be helpful to that the mind, your own mind, as it's on that process of maturing. And not expect too much, not expect it to overnight, you know, behave as you might imagine it should behave. But kind of enjoy the natural unfoldment that it goes through. And if you get discouraged, just think about how you were 6 months ago. Sometimes we don't realize, you know, how much we're growing, because it's like watching a clock. Or watching a pot boil or something like that. It's too slow. But if you look backwards, and also if you think about what type of peace do you enjoy now? What's the inner, what is your inner space? Look and see what that's like. And I would assume that you're seeing, you know, a lot of maturing. Also, maturing in the way that you talk to your own mind. This one thing, it's essential. It's essential for the mind to mature, is that the way you talk to your mind is like Swamiji would talk to you, or like a good friend, a good and loving, wise friend would talk to you. Yeah? Somebody who loves you and cares about you. That's the kind of self-talk. And if you don't have that self-talk, if you say you have negative self-talk, then what you need to do, say you notice that you have some negative self-talk where it says, or why am I like that, or how stupid, how could I be like that? Just whatever it is, negative self-talk. Then you bring in positive self-talk to talk to that negative self-talk. Right? You tell to the negative self-talk, no, no, it's okay. You know, you're doing your best. Don't worry. So you start transforming that negative self-talk or that critical self-talk. If you can do that, you'll find that then your mind starts to relax because it has a friend inside, not a critic. You've got a friend inside. Then the whole psyche will start to relax. As it starts to relax, it becomes happier. That's all of a sudden, that's the big trick, is for the psyche to relax. If you've got a critical voice inside, then you're never going to be relaxed. Because the critic, just think, in the world, somebody criticizes you, are you relaxed?
No.
I don't think so. You might work on trying to be relaxed. You know?
It's pretty awesome when it happens.
Yeah. If somebody can be critical of you and you can be relaxed, then that's a wonderful thing. And to take that internally, if there's a critical voice inside or somebody inside is hurt or in trouble, if you can have kindness to that part of your mind, your whole inner world changes. It makes the world of difference. If you can have that, then the mind will be allowed to grow and to mature, you know, in its own time, in its own way. It's kind of a very, very beautiful journey, you know. And, you know, depending on how many unconscious complexes and problems you have, those things all have to come up. But if they come up into kind of a mentoring and kindness, then they will transform. And that's all part of the process. And it's a process that takes place over years, not over months. It takes place over years, depending upon, you know, how peaceful your mind was when you started. And you can, doesn't mean that you're more or less of an adhikari. It just means this is when I start gaining this knowledge. These are the particular problems and set of things that I bring. You know, and maybe if I started gaining knowledge 10 years from now, I would have worked out some of those problems. But when you come to this teaching, you come with whatever set you've got at this particular time. And then those things work themselves out over time in the light of your knowledge. Because your knowledge gives you the peace or the safety net to allow all of those problems to work out. Because what does your knowledge make you see is that this, the being that I am, is whole and complete and changeless and available completely 100% to whatever those problems are. Changelessly present to whatever the problems are or to whatever the good situation is. I am changelessly present. And as the mind starts to recognize me, it stays with me and experiences the world. Staying with me, it experiences the world. And then that's a very safe situation. Because the nature of the self is changeless, it is ananda. And it's not going to hurt you. It's the only thing that won't hurt you. I mean, I don't mean to be mean, but Ishwar doesn't mean it. It's not trying to hurt. But if you think about it, in this creation, there is constant change. If you say that this creation there is constant change, it means in this creation there is constant death. Right? Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death on every level. And so because of that, we're vulnerable. Everything about us is vulnerable. Right? Except what? The self. The self is not vulnerable. And self is the truth of it all. Right? The self is the truth of it all. And so in a way, once we understand, in fact, we're not vulnerable at all. You know, like, in this way, but this takes time. It takes time to really own this and just actually see it fully. To think like this. For you, if If I ask you now to have a vivid imagination, you know, my meadow imagination, and in that imagination, all kinds, you have a beautiful meadow, but in the imagination, all kinds of things are starting to happen that are scary, you know, and threatening in the imagination. Are you vulnerable now? Are you vulnerable because of this, what's going on in this imagination? I would say you're not vulnerable. Depends on who you are. It depends on who you are. Because for sure, everything in the imagination is vulnerable. Like there's not one thing that isn't. And it's so vulnerable, in fact, that the whole imagination is going to go away. That's, I mean, it couldn't be more vulnerable. And every single part of that imagination is subject, is time bound and subject to change, subject to destruction. There's nothing free. But the truth of the whole imagination is not vulnerable. And so I need to recognize here now in this room, as you're looking out through your sense organs in this room, you know, the self that is the self of this room, the conscious being that is the self of this room, is not vulnerable. The truth of the room is not vulnerable. The conscious being is not vulnerable in any way. Not at all. Zero. Nothing. But everything about the room is vulnerable. See what I mean? Everything in this room is vulnerable. It's subject to death. It's subject to destruction. It's subject to moods. It's subject to... We could all be fighting. Could be a, there's no end to what could be going on. There's no end to it. Yeah. So it's not that the world isn't totally vulnerable. Bhagavan protects us with a defense system that doesn't make us have to see that all the time, how vulnerable it all is. But do you see in the midst of all of it, that which isn't vulnerable? So the mind that recognizes that stays there. But this is another thing. Mind that recognizes, I said, it stays there. It stays there, but by staying there, how to say it? There is nothing there but yourself. In other words, whatever experience you're having, whatever emotion you're having, whatever situation you're having, I am the truth of that situation. And so that's what I need to recognize. Right now, when you're looking out at this room, you can recognize the stability of your own being, just the me, your own presence. And then, if you can relax, do you notice that your presence, that there's no part of your experience in this room that's away from your own being? That's what needs to be recognized. And so that Dehatma Buddhi, all that we're talking about in Panchadashi, all that has to break down so that the mind totally recognizes the stability of myself amidst all of this changing expression. So anyway, when they're talking here, gosh, I only did one verse.
Yeah. We're going to be real old at the end.
Oh, well. Yeah, these are really important verses. I was planning to do three verses tonight, but I don't know, I had trouble getting to say exactly what I wanted to say. But we went on the circuitous route. That's okay. Om Purnamada Purnamidam
Purnat Purnam Gacchate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
No, I was thinking about this. I really like this idea of positive self-talk to yourself. You know, spotting some kind of like wrong ideas you have about your own self. But I find that it's a little hard because those wrong ideas don't come as words, or they come as moods, or kind of a sensation, you know. Rather, so it's hard to talk to a mood or.
Well, but that's a good point. It need not be hard to talk to a mood, actually. In fact, I think it's important to learn how to talk to a mood. So say if you have a mood, say it's a hurt mood or depressed mood or angry mood, whatever the mood is. To be able to just sit with that mood and talk to it and ask it, because the unconscious responds, as people have to learn how to be with the unconscious. If you ask it with kindness, you know, tell me why you're so sad. And then be patient and let that mood talk. Tell me why you're so hurt. Tell me why you're so upset. And then it'll talk to you. And then you can ask more, well, tell me more. And that's such a wonderful thing to do. It's as though the ego, the conscious mind, is coming into relationship with the unconscious. Because moods are really come out of the unconscious, you know. And so, because you can't just generate a mood.
No.
Let me be hurt. Let me be.
No, something you have to trigger.
Yeah, something triggers these moods. So, since they're not something that's willed by you, they're something that comes. They're coming from the unconscious. So if you can get into relationship with them, they'll feel it's transformative. But that's where the negative self-talk can come also. Say you have a mood. You don't like that mood. And so you have negative self-talk toward the mood, which then makes everything much worse. You know, because there's no healing that takes place.
Yeah, because when you get in a bad mood and you know it's not appropriate, you tend to kind of like beat up on yourself like, wow, you shouldn't be that way.
That's right. Instead of trying to understand. I'm not talking about giving license to things that are bad, so to speak, but say if you think, like, for raising your child. You know, are you going to... Your child has to learn discipline and, you know, have a proper behavior and all. So many things a child has to learn. But do you teach your child with love and understanding and care? Or are you, you know, a critical parent? Always criticizing. You're never going to amount to anything. There are parents like that. You're never going to amount to anything. You're just a no-good little kid. Same, talking to their children like that. And that's internalized. And so doesn't help. So what if you talk with yourself that way? It doesn't mean that, say, if you're depressed or you're angry or whatever it is, you don't want to be like that. So you're not going to say, oh, you know, it's all right. You just be angry whenever you want. That's not what I'm saying. Say you're angry. Then you say, you know, tell me why you're so angry. Tell me what it's really about. Because anger, you know, is not... anger itself is a rather shallow defense. There's always a lot of stuff underneath anger.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually a lot of kind of hurt and isolation. There's all kinds of stuff underneath anger.
Mm-hmm.
So when you feel that way, then you say, I know you're angry. You tell me what it's about. And ask more. And when you're hurt, you're feeling so hurt, tell me what's really hurting you. Because usually there's a real story underneath. you know, that we don't necessarily consciously even think about. We just think about whatever triggered us in the world. But if that's not what it's going to be, because usually we won't, in the world itself won't evoke big emotions out of us. The world will be objective to what's happening in the world and want to help in this way or the other. It's not going to evoke that. So what happens is the world triggers stuff in the unconscious that we don't have control over. And she goes, you know? And the thing is, what helps for us with the Shama and Dhamma, you know? So when Dhamma means when that thing gets triggered because somebody said something or something happened, whatever it is, then we know how to be with that. And we know that it's not really anything to do with the world. Not that terrible things don't happen in the world. Terrible things happen in the world. But we'll be with them objectively, and this is the situation, and this is how I have to work with it.
Well, is there a program for this? I mean, because it seems like when you get, say, if you get angry, there's no good speak at that time to the unconscious. I mean, you're already carried away.
There can be, because, but you have to learn how to be with your mind in that way. See, like this. When you're angry, you know it. Or it's not that you don't know you're angry. But you don't have access at that time to a supportive internal figure that'll say, I know you're angry, let's take a walk. I know you're angry, tell me about it. If that doesn't come up for you, it's because you haven't trained it to come up. You haven't learned how to do that. Most people don't know how to do that.
Like
they don't even know about it.
Well, it's a huge skill.
It's a skill.
Yeah.
This is the thing. Mm-hmm. These are skills. Mm-hmm. That just, they're skills that need to be learned. Karma yoga is a skill. You know? So this kind of self-talk, all of it's just a skill. Learning how to be with the mind, how to take care of the mind. You know?
What does it mean actually that it talks back to you? What is that process? How does that happen that it talks back to you?
I think it's really kind of how the unconscious is. The unconscious is a huge, vast storehouse of knowledge and input. And it's all there with all kinds of emotions, and it's a huge thing. But it just turns out from a lot of experimentation what we find is that if you talk to it, it will talk back to you. Like dreams also. We have imaginal capacities. You know, like say if you have a deep feeling inside of hurt or anger, some affect, you know, you can go into that affect, talk to it and see if it has an image. It'll give you so much. Why will it do that? Because that's the way the psyche is. It does that. You know, that's why, you know, Jung, when he first started out, he did so much work with associative thinking. Because the mind thinks that way, you know. You can just follow it. If you start somewhere, start with hot, then I go to cold and ice cream cone or whatever. We'll just go on and on and on, associative thinking, you know. So with associative, if you think about that, where does it get all of those images? It's all the unconscious. You know, so if your ego, your conscious mind goes into and comes into relationship with an emotion, there's two things there, right? There's the conscious mind coming into relationship with this emotion. The conscious mind addresses that emotion. Okay, when you address the emotion, you're now in an environment. You're using words to address that emotion. Now you're in that environment. It will respond based upon the words that you gave it. You have to work with it and see, because it's not. You can ask how is it, but not really why.
Yeah.
You know, because why? Ask Bhagavan.
But the other lifetimes.
Why does the unconscious work like that? Why is it that we can have that type of a relationship? It's very, once you learn about that, though, it makes all the difference in having some porousness between the conscious mind and the unconscious. And the unconscious will settle down. It feels like it now has somebody paying attention to it. Whereas they say, you know, and centuries ago, that this was so normal to have this ongoing relationship with different gods and goddesses and have talk with the unconscious in various ways. It's something that, according to Jung anyway, he talks about it, it's a skill that was lost. But if you read some of the older books, it's very much alive. That inner life.
That's actually interesting, as when I'm noticing with Mira, you know, the way I talk to her, sometimes I just realize, I get these flashes of, this is how I talk to myself also, you know. So, yeah. I mean, if I have a bad moment or something and I talk to her, or I get kind of a little impatient with her, then I realize that's kind of really how I treat my own inner child also, you know. And that they're kind of totally aligned.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
That's totally amazing. Yeah. To say the least.
It's not surprising, though.
But just like your child, you know, lights up in your love, you know, in the presence of your love and admiration, she just lights up. Your unconscious is like that. Mm. If you give it that type of love and at that respect, like that, you'll give your child so much respect, you know, for who she is, for what she is. You know, if you give your unconscious that type of love and respect, it will change and heal in so many ways. It's amazing. It's very beautiful. You know? And in light of this knowledge, when you yourself, the Atma, the self, is so stable, it is the healing factor, really. You know, and as one gains knowledge, you are just always in the presence of your own being. And that itself is so benign and so healing. But this learning how the self-talk is very helpful initially, because we tend to do the opposite.
Yeah.
And that keeps the mind in a very painful state all the time if there's negative self-talk. Just like if you probably were raised that way, if you do that a lot, you know? And you were raised, that's how it was at home. Always stressed, always worried, always tense. Always waiting for the shoe to drop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we can change that. And it's not that hard to change it either. Because the mind's so grateful. Let me give it a little...
It takes a certain commitment, like what you were saying, you know, when you were kind of annoyed or something coming up, you know, to kind of actually sit with that, you know. That takes, you have to kind of pull the brake a little bit, you know, because it's, you just, it rushes by.
Yeah, you learn how to be with it and take time. Mm-hmm. Take time with it. Take time with your own feelings and your own moods and care about them. You know, be patient and work it through. Then your mind will be a good friend. Your mind should be your best friend, not your worst enemy. We'll see it in the Gita, they talk about that. Your best friend is your own mind, can be your very best friend.
What is Dhamma and Shama again?
Shama is the ability to let the thoughts that come pass through without them grabbing you. Dhamma is when you are grabbed and overpowered by thought, you know, the mood or emotion or affect, the ability to contain it and not act it out. I actually think there's a lot of, to really understanding Dhamma, that you need a psychology to really understand it. Otherwise, you're just, you know. But what you need is to, when you're caught by a thought or emotion, you have a reaction, then for the Dhamma to be really effective, you need to know how to go in and be with that emotion so that you can sit with it, you know, and work it through.
You can also paint yourself in a corner if you don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, dogma gets created that way.
The what?
Dogma gets created.
Dogma?
You should be like this.
Yeah.
Be pure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another problem. Bhagavan made it challenging. You know?
The more I listen to this Gita, the more I like it. It's kind of, it grows on you, you know? Instead of thinking, oh, I want an apprenticeship. You know?
Well, this Gita, the Gita is wonderful. Mm. It's thorough. Especially having Swamiji's. Did everybody get a handout?
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing, worth studying.
Well, the Gita can be taught as though it's an Upanishad. It's not.
It is an Upanishad.
Yeah, it's not different.
It's considered an Upanishad. It's not an Upanishad, but it's considered an Upanishad.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of every chapter, we chant that, you know.
Well, when you said that Bhagavan shields us from...
I was talking about the defense system, you know, where you don't have to... The mind doesn't... is not always living on the edge of death.
Yeah.
Right, because the whole system will protect you from that. Even though you know it, you don't have to. It's not there in your face all the time.
Right. Is that also where further in the Gita, where Arjuna says to Bhagavan, he says, show me who you are totally.
Yeah.
And then he shows him, and then Arjuna says, no more, that's enough.
Yeah, it was a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
He got overwhelmed.
But you know, if Arjuna was firm in his knowledge and understanding as a yoni, he wouldn't have freaked. Do you think?
I have no idea. He might have just decided to close his eyes.
Oh.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's probably
a big thing to see.